What I have in mind to do today, starting today and for the next 5 weeks after today, is to give a series of talks on what's known as, in English, as the five precepts. And today I thought I would do kind of an introductory talk and then take each of the five for those next five weeks. And the five precepts are very important in our tradition and very central to our practice. And so I'd like to, I think it's not important to talk about them. Also, in a few weeks I'm going to do a refuge ceremony for some people taking the refuge class. And the refuge part of the refuge ceremony is a kind of a commitment to the precepts, and part of it is taking the precepts. And so it seems like it's an opportune time to talk about precepts some. In the teachings of the Buddha, in the training that the Buddha laid out, the training, spiritual training, it's sometimes divided into three different trainings. And the first training is the training in virtue. And the word is sila. The second training is a training in samadhi. And samadhi here, in this context, can just mean inner cultivation or development. And then the last training is a training in wisdom or insight. And these are the three trainings that lead to awakening, lead to liberation, lead to freedom. And all of the Buddhist teachings and all of the Buddhist practices can be subsumed under these three trainings. The first training then has to do with sila. And it's a very interesting word. I think probably one of the best English words to translate it is the word virtue. The word ethics is a little bit confusing, or has a lot of associations in English, that some of them which are good and some of them which are confusing for people, or sometimes are off-putting for people. But virtue, the word sila in its original meaning means character or nature or like a habit, something that we, I know one monk who likes to translate it as what's normal, normalcy. So sila has to do with character. More ethics, sometimes we think of ethics has to do with rules. But sila has to do with character. And so when we talk about a training, one of the three trainings, it's a training in character, a training in some inner qualities that can be developed. And here the idea is that integrity or ethical sensitivity or virtue is not something that's a matter of rules or understanding of what's what, but has a lot to do with how we develop ourselves, the kind of heart we create, the kind of character we make for ourselves, our dispositions that we create, the habits we make, the kind of foundation out of how we want to live our life, how we normally want to respond in normal circumstances to life as it is. And so it's a training, so it does involve changing ourselves. And one of the things the Buddhist tradition will say over and over again, in some form or other, is that the human being is malleable. And if you don't take responsibility for shaping your heart, your mind, who you are, there are a lot of forces in society that will do it for you. And so you could just kind of passively go along and be shaped by the forces around you, or you can take some responsibility for it, at least to kind of be mindful that the forces of society don't influence you too much. And some of the popular forces that exist in our culture are not very savory. And in fact, the way that watching children growing up, now that I have children, watching the way some children in our culture are impacted by violence and sexuality that appear on television and in music, it's just phenomenal. You know, I've probably never existed in human culture or society before, except during wartime, that children were exposed to the kind of influences they are now. And sometimes it's not very pleasant to see the results that happen. So at least to somehow take some responsibility for how we're being shaped. And there's our parts of our personality, who we are, which maybe is genetic, who knows how it's got there, but it seems that it's not going to change at all. And there are other parts of something, you know, deep aspects of who we are that can be changed, that can be cultivated or developed, awakened, changed direction in radical ways. And so so the Buddhist tradition wants to emphasize over and over again the radical possibility of change that can happen. One of the very radical stories that I read about once was there was a young boy, I think he was a teenager, who killed another teenager, another boy. And killing, I think, apparently the only child of this mother. And the killer was raised in very difficult circumstances, kind of without parents almost, and grew up in the violent streets, maybe was a member of a gang, and had nothing to live for, no one who really cared for him or took care of him, except for maybe the gang. And so he was sentenced to jail. And at his trial, after he was sentenced, the mother was offered a chance to say something. And she spoke up and said, "I'm going to kill you." Something like that, to the killer. So then she waited a few years, apparently. And then she started to visit the killer in his jail cell, or his jail, do visits. And started doing regular visits. And would bring him something, I don't know if they could bring him to jails, but started developing a relationship, a friendship with the person who killed her child. And eventually became kind of his friend and kind of a maternal figure. And he had, no one else was visiting him, no one else cared about him enough to visit him in prison. And so he, I guess, looked forward to these visits from this woman, the mother of the person he killed. And they've developed a very close relationship after all these visits she made. And eventually he was released from jail and he came to live with her. And she kind of helped him get started his new life. And I don't know what exactly she did for him, but got it started, his new life. And he kind of lived with her like a son. And at some point when his life was well established, she said to him, "Remember at that trial, I promised I'd kill you? I did." And so a radical change of character, you know, that could happen. There's a famous story that's told maybe too many times. I think it's maybe Richard Heckler. He was an Aikido, maybe not, but anyway, Aikido student who was in Japan studying Aikido. And Aikido is supposed to be the way of love. That's what I in Aikido means, love. Ki, I guess, means like energy. And Do is the way of love. Because you're supposed to love your opponent to defeat. You're supposed to not really actually defeat your opponent, but somehow change the circumstances. And this guy was studying Aikido. And he was, late one night, he was taking the train home. And there was a drunk who was being quite obnoxious and angry and threatening to be violent, I guess, on the train. And this American Aikido student said, "Oh, you know, I'm not supposed to use my Aikido except maybe in self-defense, but this guy has really looked like he's going to be dangerous and cause, you know, for other people on the train. And finally, you know, this will be easy, you know, this guy's drunk, and I can finally, you know, be justified to use my Aikido training." And so he was just about to stand up and defend the train from this drunk guy. And just before that, as I remember the story, this old guy who was sitting on the train somehow reached over to the drunk and said, "Oh, you, come sit down right next to me here. And tell me, you know, what's going on with you?" And the guy started telling him his story. And after a while, the drunk started crying and he was having a hard life and hard time. And the old guy just sat there and listened to him. And And eventually the guy quieted down, and eventually, I don't know, anyway, certainly the danger was over. So here, again, a change of character. Someone who was angry and belligerent and perhaps threatening to be violent was changed by someone who met him and saw him and received him with compassion and kindness. And rather than meeting him with hostility or with violence, meeting violence with violence, he was met with kindness, and it dissolved the whole thing. Maybe you'll forgive me to give you one more story that I've heard. I know of again, it's an Aikido story of some guy going into Aikido teacher going into some place inner city where there's some violent youth, and offering to teach some kids there how to be better fighters, better killers even, or something. And it's kind of a strange thing to offer to do, but he taught them Aikido. And after a few years or some time of being trained in Aikido, they didn't want to fight anymore. And the idea being that if you get trained in some inner discipline like this, it changes your character in such a way that that you're not so liable to act from the place inside of us that acts from anger or violence, hostility, greed, kind of being callous to the people that we encounter. So Buddhism puts a great emphasis on how we can change, that we can change our character, our dispositions, if we'd like to. Some of us are quite happy with who we are, don't feel a need to change, but some of us could see some room for improvement. And the idea in Buddhism is not to judge ourselves as being good or bad based on how we are, but rather the idea is to see become familiar with ourselves, to know ourselves well enough, and to see what can I do about who I am that allows me to live wiser and allows me to live in such a way that I can move towards greater freedom. Freedom in my own heart, freedom in my mind, and also freedom in my actions and how I act. So that when we act in the world, our activities can be a gift to the world rather than a harm to the world. One of the ideas of the precepts, the five precepts, ethical precepts, is that they're understood to be gifts. The people who live by them are giving a gift to the people around them, people who encounter them. So the word sila means character or nature or habit that we have. So as a training in developing that part of ourselves. There are lists of different kinds of character that a person can develop. One of the very common lists is the 10 silas, or 10 qualities of character. And these 10 are not killing, not taking what's not given, not engaging in improper sexuality, not engaging in lying, not slandering, not engaging in harsh speech, not engaging in frivolous speech, not being covetous, not being not having ill will, not acting from ill will, and not having wrong views, harmful views. So look at this, 10 qualities of character can be developed. So you can develop these qualities. And often in Buddhism, when we talk about things that are negative, the implication is you're developing positive qualities as well, the corollaries, the opposites. So when we're developing the quality of not killing, it's actually developing our compassion. When we're developing the quality of not taking what's not given, it's developing generosity or contentment, variety of things. Not engaging sexual misconduct, it's developing, again, contentment or respect. Not lying is developing truth, truthfulness, and so forth. Down we go. So it's a training. The most famous list of the five, a list of silas that comes down to us in modern world, is what's called the five silas, the Panchasila. And there are four of them are the first four that I just gave you. And this is what the topic is for the next 6 weeks. So the first is not killing. The second is not taking what is not given. The third is no sexual misconduct. The fourth is not lying. And then the fifth is not intoxicating the mind with drugs and alcohol. So those are the five. Now these are called silas. They're called qualities of character. So it's very interesting they should be called that, as opposed to commandments or rules. So there's a few things to be said about these. One of the ideas in the Buddhist tradition is that these five silas, five qualities, characterizes someone who is spiritually mature. That someone who's spiritually mature, who's awake, will naturally act that way. Will naturally act in such a way that they're not going to kill intentionally. They're not going to intentionally steal. They're not going to intentionally engage in sexual misconduct. They're not going to intentionally lie. And they're not going to intentionally intoxicate themselves. And so it's rather than something that they do, like a restraint, like that they do, they hold themselves really tight, they lock themselves in the room, and so they're not going to do any of those things at all because they're, you know. It's actually expressed as a kind of a freedom of the heart where the heart is simply not going to act that way. That motivations are not going to arise in that person. And so they can go in situations that might, for other people, be very tempting. They're not going to be tempted because that inclination is not there. And I find that very inspiring, that that's what the tradition holds up, because it means that an ethical sensitivity, ethical behavior, becomes a natural part of who we are, as opposed to something that we have to consider or restrain ourselves or diminish ourselves by living according to. Some people, when they hear about ethical rules, they feel like they're diminished by it. Oh no, you know. The idea in Buddhism is actually you're enhanced. Your life is enhanced when you have developed this character, this quality that lives by these five things, these five qualities of character. So virtue is probably a good translation for the English, the Pali, sila. So there's pancha sila. There's also something called pancha sika, the five trainings. The five trainings are training guidelines, training rules, if you like, that people take on voluntarily in order to train themselves in mindfulness, train themselves in virtue and character, train themselves in compassion, in order to train themselves, in order to create the foundations for a furthered spiritual growth. So they're voluntary trainings. Now these five voluntary trainings are the same, these five panchasika, five sikas, five trainings, are the same as the five silas, the five virtues. So the same list, but the understanding of how they are, how they're held, is differently. One is just expressing a character that we have or can have as we mature. The other is actually a rule, rules we're going to live by. And generally in Theravadan Buddhism, lay people will do this voluntarily, taking the five precepts, and they'll often do it temporarily. It's very common, for example, in our tradition here, if you go on a meditation retreat, that you're asked to live by the five precepts during the retreat, and lived by them fairly strictly. And it's great to go on retreats, like at Spirit Rock, because it's really a safe place to be, because everyone there is dedicated to living by the precepts. You could drop your wallet in the middle of the path there and not notice it for a few days. And if it's not there in a few days, it's probably in the manager's office waiting for you, because no one's going to take it. People live there without any locks on their doors at Spirit Rock. Have you ever been slept at night without your doors locked? How many of you have ever done that? Some of you have. Half of you have slept without locking your doors?
By mistake.
By mistake. Sorry?
My door.
You leave your door open.
So hot.
Mm-hmm. So there are people who do it, but some people would never do that. And anyway, Spirit Rock, you know, these retreats is a place where people feel safe. And I remember there was a woman who came to Spirit Rock many years ago, and she wrote a letter afterwards, and she Spirit Rock, and said, you know, I don't know where she came from, but she said, being at Spirit Rock was the first time in my life where I felt safe enough to sleep with the doors unlocked and to be able to walk around at night by myself. Pretty phenomenal. Some people don't have that degree of safety in their lives. And you come to a retreat and you're together with 80 strangers. And it's pretty safe. Don't find, you know, it's hard to find a safer environment to be in. So at Spirit Rock is one of the places where we live by these five precepts. So on retreats. And people take the precepts at the beginning of the retreat and they're expected for the duration of the retreat to live by those precepts. And it gets quite nice. You see, we get all these notes in the wintertime when it's raining at Spirit Rock. There's all these snails, these slugs that kind of start walking across the pathways. And there's a lot of them. And so people, you know, if you're not really mindful, it's really easy to step on them. And even though it's a mindfulness retreat, there are people who are not mindful enough. And there usually are a few slugs that get squashed. And then we get these, teachers get these notes. Please make announcements. They'll tell people to be more careful when they walk so they don't step on the slugs. And I love it that people are so concerned about the slugs. Or, you know, or some insect comes into the meditation hall. People are very carefully, will, you know, shepherd it outside as opposed to... And I find it actually quite jarring when people do that to mosquitoes. It's, you know, I find it quite... And so that's one of the places we live by the precepts is at Spirit Rock. In more traditional setting, Theravadan setting in Thailand, in Burma, people sometimes live by the precepts, commit themselves to the precepts for one day, like often on the full moon day or the new moon day. It's kind of a like the Sunday of Buddhists. And they'll go spend the day at the monastery or just take for that day, they'll commit themselves to the precepts. Or some people will commit themselves to one or two or three or four of the precepts rather than all five. So there's some idea, these are training precepts. And so we're going to try our best to live by these and train ourselves by using this. And it's a very strong way of training, depending on how subtle you get to understanding the precepts. So one of the ways to see the value of such a training is to begin appreciating that these training rules are meant to be to stop us from doing the opposite, or stop us from doing these things, to stop us from killing, stop us from stealing, stop us from sexual misconduct, stop us from lying, and stop us from intoxication. And then we can ask, what is the motivation? What is it? What are the conditions inside ourselves that brings us to want to kill, steal, sexually misconduct, lie, and intoxicate ourselves? What is it? What are some of the forces inside of us? And so in that it's a training precepts, we're trying to look and try to understand ourselves by having this fence around us, by having this commitment. And then we start, what's going on in me? What's happening here? So what's happening when we're trying to kill? My guess is most of you haven't killed. But maybe. I met some people who've killed before. And I didn't know quite what to say to them. They did it as soldiers. But, you know, things like insects. Many people in our kind of community here will ask me, what about those snails? What about the ants or the termites? What about that? And I love it that people ask. That people stop long enough to ask the question. You know, is this appropriate? Should I do this? Should I just, you know, squash the snails? Or should I spray my house? Is there some, you know, questioning going on? And is there some value in the life that we may be thinking about killing? And maybe there's other ways. Maybe there's some way of respecting that life. And what is it that motivates that act of killing? Even something like an ant or snails. What motivates that? Is it because we're lazy? You know, there is another way, but it takes so much more work. there's a way of saving those lives, but still protecting the garden or the house, but it's a lot of work. Is it because of greed? Is it because of fear? Is it because of, well, many things. The main things that come into place. What's going on there? What's going on when we're motivated to be violent? Violent takes many different forms. It takes, physical forms, verbal forms. And what motivates us when we want to be violent? What are the causes and conditions inside ourselves? So when we take these as training precepts, we're asked to turn around and have them as a mirror to understand ourselves deeply. And when we try to understand ourselves, when we use the precepts to understand ourselves, then they're not used as kind of blind rules or kind of commandments that thou shalt live this way or else. You're using it as a mirror to try to understand what's really going on here in deep way, so that we can begin taking some responsibility for our character, for our training, what's going on inside of us. Sorry?
He's trying not to kill anything.
Trying, that's good. And when people work with these training precepts, then there are subtleties that are very, so-called subtleties, that become more and more interesting. My guess is most of you don't go make a habit of stealing. I'd be very surprised if many of you made a habit of stealing. But it wouldn't surprise me if some of you steal in small ways. Very small. Maybe you don't even think of the stealing. I mean, the classic idea of taking pencils from work, right? Oh, that's fine, take pencils from work. It's fine to, cheat a little bit of my taxes. It's fine to, to do this and that. No one's going to notice if I do this. Or, if the person at the store gives me a little bit more change back than was due to me, that's okay, because they probably overcharge me anyway for what I'm buying. And so it's only fair. And so it's a little, but is that really right to do that? And what is it that motivates us? Again, the mirror goes back, what's happening for us really? What's happening here and what's happening out there? What's happening with us? And also, what does it say about how we understand others and the relationship we have with others? So there's this reflection that's going on. Who am I? Who's the other? What's my relationship to both of them? And to question that and to ponder that and not take what's given or the inherited view of self and other in the relationship, but being questioning it and becoming more sensitive to that relationship. The wording is very interesting. It doesn't say don't steal. It says don't take what is not given. It's kind of a higher order than not stealing. So for monastics, for example, they take this very strictly. And when a Buddhist monk or nun goes into someone's home, they are not allowed to pick up anything in someone's home until they're given permission. Like if there's a book on the coffee table, it's there for to show your guests. You have your beautiful book, and they actually can't go pick up that book unless they actually said, please, if you want to look at that book, please do, because they're not supposed to in any kind of way approach taking what's not given, even if it's just to borrow it for a moment like that. So I don't know if lay people need to live to that extreme, but monastics live that way. And partly that's to help them preserve their integrity. But also, it's a training for them to be very mindful of their impulses, so they don't act out of kind of mindless behavior. Oh, just, without thinking what they're doing. Oh, pick this up, But everything they're asked to do, they're asked to do it mindfully, very consciously. So the high value that Buddhism puts on being mindful and conscientious. So there's virtue, there's training rules, and then there is principles. And the principles behind sila in Buddhism, behind this virtue or character development, is twofold. One is the principle is that of compassion and liberation. These two twins that are so important for our tradition. So it's a training in compassion. What is a compassionate thing to do in our circumstances? And the precepts have to do with our relationship to other people. We don't usually kill unless there's somebody to kill, something to kill, some animal, some being. We don't usually steal unless there's someone we're stealing from. We don't usually lie unless we're lying to someone. We don't usually engage in sexual misconduct unless there's somebody who we're engaged in. And I've never seen any problem with masturbation in Buddhism. So usually sexuality has to do with something that's in Buddhism you do with other people, this precept. So the fifth precept maybe you do alone, get intoxicated. But the first four have to do with our relationship to other people. So so there's a principle here of compassion. The principle is not to cause harm, maybe to try to cause benefit. So what is it? It's a training and learning to do that. And the other principle is that of liberation. So what is it that helps me become liberated? Because what you probably find is those times when you're most likely to break the precepts, go against these training rules, when you're not acting from those place of virtue, you probably find that you're probably attached or clinging to something. You probably find that there's some place where the heart is constrained or constricted or afraid, or kind of you've lost control of yourself. There's kind of you're acting compulsively in some way. And so there's no freedom in that behavior. And so if you're really free, would you do these things? If you're really acting from freedom. So the precepts helped us to see where are the places where I'm not free. And that goes a little bit against some people's kind of American ideal of I just want to be free to do whatever I want. In Buddhism, the idea of freedom is not freedom to do whatever you want. It's a different kind of freedom. We're talking about, Buddhism talks about freedom from compulsion. Freedom from our own impulses. So rather than acting kind of freely from our impulses, shop until you drop. That's the American ideal. Freedom to shop. That would be great, wouldn't it? That's what it's come down to. It used to be freedom to vote. And now it's just freedom. You know, but the Buddhist ideal is not necessarily free to shop, but rather free from the impulses to shop. Free from the, you can still shop if it's wise, but free from the compulsion to do it. Free from that which forces us to act against our better judgment. So the five precepts then represent principles of non-harming, compassion, and liberation. They represent trainings in character. They represent how we live our life. When we become spiritually mature, and they represent a training that Buddhists will take on so they can learn about themselves, so they can train themselves. So the sila and precepts are multifunctional, a lot of different aspects to them. And different people relate to the different aspects that they have different meaning for different people. So we'll go through these five precepts over the next 5 weeks. And they have to do with some of the most interesting aspects of human life. And I haven't seen a lot of soap operas. But, you know, a lot of soap operas, don't they have to do something to do with some relationship to the ethics and virtue and precepts and people are fascinated in the movies. And, you know, if people were really virtuous in these movies, we wouldn't go to movies very much. these precepts speak to some of the most interesting, you know, fascinating parts of human life, some of the most important ones, and some of the most significant in terms of creating harm or lack of it. And also these five precepts speak to areas in life which are not necessarily so obvious. Some people will think, well, I have nothing, you know, I'm basically a virtuous person and I don't need to hear about ethics or virtue. I don't want to hear about it. But there are issues in our society, in how we live in our society, which are not obvious, don't necessarily flow, even from someone maybe who is enlightened. It doesn't necessarily flow automatically from their open, free heart. But they have to do with social issues and contextual issues of what's going on. Just one small example is when I was going to college many years ago, there was a book called The Tragedy of the Commons. And the idea of, it was fine. The commons meant the commons was in the villages and towns of New England. They had a little common ground, a park or a square in the middle of this village that everyone owned, everyone had in common. And people could do whatever they wanted to do there. So we have this land, this space, and then here, which we have in common to everybody, like the air and the oceans and some of the wildernesses and stuff. And when there was only one automobile, the first automobile, it was not an ethical issue particularly about driving it. And they didn't have any mufflers either. So, no catalytic converters. And so they just spewed out all the smoke, but it wasn't really an ethical issue. But at some point, when we get 2 billion cars on the planet, does at some point become an ethical issue? That, the kind of car we drive, or that we drive at all. Or we don't want it to be an ethical issue because we don't want anybody to tell us what we should do with driving our cars. It's like an American religion, our cars. And so, but does it become an ethical issue? When does it become an ethical issue? At the second car that was made, the third, the hundredth, the thousandth, when we got to a million, when we got to a billion, when does it become an issue? When is the tipping point? And so there's no obvious answer to that. And I don't think an open, liberated heart will say, well, this is the right time, unless some investigation. So there's a lot of issues in our society that we have to negotiate, that the precepts relate to. How do we live without killing? How do we live without taking what's not given? What does it relate to? Does it have a say about the things we buy, things we do? So there are bigger issues. And one of the places where we see this in America is right here on our street corner. I don't know how many of you have been here Thursday or Friday morning, but Thursday or Friday morning is very interesting to drive by our street corner here, because across the street is Planned Parenthood, where apparently they do abortions. And on all the street corners except for Planned Parenthood street corner, there's anti-abortion protests, and they're quite graphic. And the big posters they have of aborted babies. So one of the ethical fault lines of our culture happens right here on our front steps. And so what is Buddhism have to say about that? Does Buddhism have any guidelines or help in helping to, us understand the issues around things like abortion? The first precept is not to kill. How does that relate to the question of abortion? So there are these bigger issues that the questions of virtue and precepts and training rules can relate to in our society. So perhaps in the course of these 5 weeks, we can look at the personal, the interpersonal, and also these larger social questions of ethics, and hope in a way that's hopefully helpful for us in cultivating our compassion and our liberation. Is that okay? So I see we have a couple of minutes before 9. Is there maybe one question someone would like to ask, or any of this? Concern? Comment? Yes, please.
Yes, in yoga
they have yamas. And the yamas are, there's also, I know the 5 yamas in yoga, and they're almost the same, right? I think there's four of the same ones. They don't intoxicate. No intoxication. I think the fifth one is, or the fourth one, but the one that's the substitute for it is no covetousness. Is that right?
No coveting.
No coveting. Yeah. The 5 precepts are, in some form or other, I think most world religions have something like the 5 precepts or the 5 training precepts. And there's little variations, but it's kind of basically the same. And the 10 precepts, the 10 silas that I listed earlier, one of them is no covetousness. So it's there also. And I like that. That it seems it's a common to many religions, and it points to me that it's not something we have to worry about, you know, imposing from the outside, but rather it's something that can be born and spring from the inside as we become more free, more sensitive, more open, more mindful. It's kind of a quality of the awakened heart rather than some kind of rule. Whenever, if you read some of the many books on Buddhism in English where they talk about the precepts, one of the most common statements that Western teachers will say very quickly, not necessarily second line, but very quickly when they start talking about the five precepts, they say, these are not commandments. They say over and over again, they're not commandments. They don't come from the outside. In a sense, they come from the inside. Thank you very much.